things to deal with than laundry. Someone had found husband refreshment. A plate of partially eaten bread and butter and a half-full mug of buttermilk lay on the table. So did husband, who had put his head on his folded arms and fallen asleep. Adzo crouched on the table beside him, fascinated by the bushy grey whiskers that quivered like antennae with the Quaker's reverberating snores. The kitten was just reaching an experimental paw toward husband's open mouth when Jamie nabbed him by the scruff of the neck and dropped him neatly into my hands. "Mr. Husband," he said quietly, leaning over the table. "Your servant, sir." Husband snorted, blinked, then sat up suddenly, nearly upsetting the buttermilk. He goggled briefly at me and Adso, then seemed to recollect where he was, for he shook himself and half rose, nodding to Jamie. "Friend Fraser," he said thickly, I have been... Jamie brushed away his apologies and sat down opposite him, casually picking up a slice of bread and butter from the plate. "May I be of service to you, Mr. Husband?" Husband scrubbed a hand over his face, which did nothing to improve his looks, but did seem to rouse him more fully. Seen clearly in the soft afternoon light of the kitchen, he looked even worse than he had outside, his eyes pouched and bloodshot, and his grizzled hair and beard tangled in knots. He was only in his mid-50s, I knew, but looked at least 10 years older. He made an attempt to straighten his coat, and nodded to me, then Jamie.
"I thank thee for the hospitality of thy welcome, Mrs. Fraser, and thee also, Mr. Fraser. I have come indeed to ask a service of thee, if I may." "You may ask, of course," Jamie said courteously.
He took a bite of bread and butter, raising his eyebrows in question.
"Will thee buy my horse?"
Jamie's eyebrows stayed raised. He chewed slowly, considering, then swallowed.
"Why?"
Why, indeed? It would have been a great deal easier for husband to sell a horse in Salem or High Point if he didn't want to ride as far as Cross Creek. No one in his right mind would venture to a remote place like the Ridge simply to sell a horse. I set Adso on the floor and sat down beside Jamie, waiting for the answer. Husband gave him a look, clear and direct for all its bloodshot quality.
"Thee is appointed a colonel of militia, I'm told." "For my sins," Jamie said, bread poised in the air. "Do you suppose the governor has given me money to provide mounts for my regiment?"
He took a bite, half smiling. The corner of husband's mouth lifted briefly in acknowledgement of the joke. A colonel of militia supplied his regiment himself, counting upon eventual reimbursement from the assembly. One reason why only men of property were so appointed, and a major reason why the appointment was not considered an unalloyed honour.
"If he had, I should be pleased to take some of it."
At Jamie's gesture of invitation, husband reached out and selected another slice of bread and butter, which he munched gravely, looking at Jamie under thick salt and pepper brows. Finally, he shook his head.
"Nay, friend James, I must sell my stock to pay the fines levied upon me by the court. If I do not sell what I can, it may be seized. And if I will not, then I have no choice save to quit the colony and remove my family elsewhere. And if I remove, then I must dispose of what I cannot take, for what price I may get."
A small line formed between Jamie's brows.
"Aye, I see," he said slowly. "I would help you, Herman, in any way I might. You ken that, I hope. But I've scarce 2 shillings in cash money, not even proclamation money, let alone sterling. If there is anything I have that would be of use to you, though..."
Husband smiled slightly, his harsh features softening.
"Aye, friend James, thy friendship and thy honour are of great use to me, indeed. For the rest..."
He sat back from the table, groping in the small shoulder bag he had set down beside him. He came up with a thin letter bearing a red wax seal. I recognised the seal, and my chest tightened.
I met the messenger at Pumpkin Town, husband said, watching as Jamie took the letter and put his thumb beneath the flap. I offered to carry the letter to thee, as I was bound here in any case.
Jamie's brows lifted, but his attention was focused on the sheet of paper in his hand. I came close to see over his shoulder.
November the 22nd, 1770. Colonel James Fraser. Whereas I am informed that those who style themselves regulators have gathered together in some force near Salisbury, I have sent word to General Waddell to proceed thither at once with the militia troops at his disposal, in hopes of dispersing this unlawful assemblage. You are requested and commanded to gather such men as you judge fit to serve in a regiment of militia, and proceed with them to Salisbury, with as much dispatch as may be managed, so as to join the General's troops on or before 15th of December, at which point he will march upon Salisbury. So far as possible, bring with you flour and other provisions sufficient to supply your men for a space of 2 weeks. Your obedient servant, William Tryon.
The room was quiet, save for the soft rumbling of the cauldron over the coals in the hearth. Outside I could hear the women talking in short bursts, interspersed with grunts of effort, and the smell of lye soap drifted through the open window, mingling with the scents of stew and rising bread. Jamie looked up at husband.
"Again what this says?"
The Quaker nodded, the lines of his face sagging in sudden fatigue.
"The messenger told me. The governor has no wish to keep his intent secret, after all."
Jamie gave a small grunt of agreement and glanced at me.
"No, the governor wouldn't want to keep it secret. So far as Tryon was concerned, the more people who knew that Waddell was heading for Salisbury with a large militia troop, the better. Hence also the setting of a specific date. Any wise soldier would prefer to intimidate an enemy rather than fight him. And given that Tryon had no official troops, discretion was certainly the better part of valour."
"What about the regulators?" I asked husband. "What are they planning to do?" He looked mildly startled.
"Do? If your people are assembling, it is presumably to some purpose," Jamie pointed out, a slightly sardonic tone to his voice.
Husband heard it, but didn't take exception.
"Certainly there is purpose," he said, drawing himself up with some dignity, "though thee is mistaken to say these men are mine, in any way save that of brethren, as are all men. But as to purpose, it is only to protest the abuses of power, as are all too common these days. The imposition of illegal taxes, the unwarranted seizure of..."
Jamie made an impatient gesture, cutting him off.
"Aye, Herman, I've heard it. Worse, I've read your writings about it. And if that is the regulator's purpose, what is yours?"
The Quaker stared at him, thick brows raised and mouth half open in question.
"Tryon has no wish to keep his intentions secret," Jamie elaborated, "but you might. It doesn't serve the regulator's interest that those intentions be carried out, after all."
He stared at husband, rubbing a finger slowly up and down the long, straight bridge of his nose. Husband raised a hand and scratched at his chin.
"Thee mean, why did I bring that?"
He nodded toward the letter, which lay open on the table.
"When I might have suppressed it."
Jamie nodded patiently.
"I do."
Husband heaved a deep sigh and stretched himself, joints cracking audibly. Small white puffs of dust rose from his coat, dissipating like smoke. He settled back into himself then, blinking and looking more comfortable.
"Putting aside any consideration of the honesty of such conduct, friend James, I did say that it was thy friendship that would be of most use to me." "So you did."
The hint of a smile touched the corner of Jamie's mouth.
"Save for the sake of argument that General Waddell does march upon a group of regulators," husband suggested. "Is it to the benefit of the regulators to face men who do not know them and are inimical to them? Or to face neighbours who know them and are perhaps in some sympathy with their cause. "Better the devil you ken than the devil you don't, eh?" Jamie suggested. "And I'm the devil you ken."
"I see."
A slow smile blossomed on husband's face, matching the one on Jamie's.
"One of them, friend James. I have been a horse these 10 days past, selling my stock and visiting in one house and another across the western part of the colony. The regulation makes no threat, seeks no destruction of property. We wish only that our complaints be heard and addressed. It is to draw attention to the widespread nature and the justness of these complaints that those most offended are assembling at Salisbury. But I cannot well expect sympathy from those who lack information of the offence, after all." The smile faded from Jamie's face. "You may have my sympathy, Herman, and welcome. But if it comes to it, I am colonel of militia. I will have a duty to be carried out, whether that duty is to my liking or no."
Husband flapped a hand, dismissing this.
"I would not ask thee to forsake duty, if it comes. I pray it does not."
He leaned forward a little across the table.
"I would ask something of thee, though. My wife, my children, if I must leave hurriedly. Send them here. They'll be safe."
Husband sat back then, shoulders slumping. He closed his eyes and breathed once, deeply, then opened them and set his hands on the table as though to rise.
"I thank thee. As to the mare, keep her. If my family should have need of her, someone will come. If not, I should greatly prefer that thee have the use of her, rather than some corrupt sheriff."
I felt Jamie move, wanting to protest, and laid a hand on his leg to stop him. Herman Husband needed reassurance, much more than he needed a horse he couldn't keep.
"We'll take good care of her," I said, smiling into his eyes, "and of your family if the need comes. Tell me, what's her name?"
"The mare."
Herman rose to his feet, and a sudden smile split his face, lightening it amazingly.
"Her name is Jerusha, but my wife calls her Mistress Piggy. I'm afraid she does possess a great appetite," he added apologetically to Jamie, who had stiffened perceptibly at the word pig. "No matter," Jamie said, dismissing pigs from his mind with an obvious effort.
He rose, glancing at the window, where the rays of the afternoon sun were turning the polished pinewood of the sills and floors to molten gold.
"It grows late, Herman. Will you not sup with us and stop the night?"
Husband shook his head and stooped to retrieve his shoulder bag.
"Nay, friend James, I thank thee. I have many places still to go."
I insisted that he wait, though, while I made up a parcel of food for him, and he went with Jamie to saddle his mule while I did so. I heard them talking quietly together as they came back from the paddock, voices so low-pitched that I couldn't make out the words. As I came out onto the back porch with a package of sandwiches and beer, though, I heard Jamie say to him with a sort of urgency,
"Are you sure, Herman, that what you do is wise or necessary?"
Husband didn't answer immediately, but took the parcel from me with a nod of thanks. Then he turned to Jamie, the mule's bridle in his other hand.
"I am minded," he said, glancing from Jamie to me, "of James Naylor. Thee will have heard of him."
Jamie looked as blank as I did, and Herman smiled in his beard.
"He was an early member of the Society of Friends, one of those who joined George Fox, who began the society in England. James Naylor was a man of forceful conviction, though he was individual in his expression of it. Upon one famous occasion, he walked naked through the snow whilst shouting doom to the city of Bristol. George Fox inquired of him then, 'Is thee sure the Lord told thee to do this?'"
The smile widened, and he put his hat carefully back on his head.
"He said that he was. And so am I, friend James. God keep thee and thy family."
Chapter 20. Shooting lessons. Brianna glanced back over her shoulder, feeling guilty. The house below had disappeared beneath a yellow sea of chestnut leaves, but the cries of her child still rang in her ears. Roger saw her look back down the mountainside and frowned a little, though his voice was light when he spoke.
"He'll be fine, Hen. You know your mother and Lizzie will take good care of him."
"Lizzie will spoil him rotten," she agreed, but with a queer tug at her heart at the admission. She could easily see Lizzie carrying Jemmy to and fro all day, playing with him, making faces at him, feeding him rice pudding with molasses. Jemmy would love the attention once he got over the distress of her leaving. She felt a sudden surge of territorial feeling regarding Jemmy's small pink toes. She hated the very idea of Lizzie playing 10 wee piggies with him. She hated leaving him, period. His shrieks of panic as she pried his grip from her shirt and handed him over to her mother echoed in her mind, magnified by imagination, and his tear-stained look of outraged betrayal lingered in her mind. At the same time, her need to escape was urgent. She couldn't wait to peel Jemmy's sticky, clutching hands off her skin and speed away into the morning, free as one of the homing geese that honked their way south through the mountain passes. She supposed, reluctantly, that she wouldn't feel nearly so guilty about leaving Jemmy had she not secretly been so eager to do it. "I'm sure he'll be fine," she reassured herself more than Roger. "It's just, I've never really left him for very long before."
"Mm-hmm."
Roger made a non-committal noise that might have been interpreted as sympathy. His expression, however, made it clear that he personally thought it well past time that she had left the baby. A momentary spurt of anger warmed her face, but she bit her tongue. He hadn't said anything, after all, had clearly made an effort not to say anything, in fact. She could make an effort, too, and she supposed that it was perhaps not fair to quarrel with someone on the basis of what you thought they were thinking. She choked off the acrimonious remark she'd had in mind, and instead smiled at him.
"Nice day, isn't it?"
The wary look faded from his face, and he smiled too, his eyes warming to a green as deep and fresh as the moss that lay in thick beds at the shaded feet of the trees they passed.
"Great day," he said. "Feels good to be out of the house, eh?"
She shot a quick look at him, but it seemed to be a simple statement of fact with no ulterior motives behind it. She didn't answer, but nodded in agreement, lifting her face to the errant breeze that wandered through the spruce and fir around them. A swirl of rusty aspen leaves blew down, clinging momentarily to the homespun of their breeches and the light wool of their stockings.
"Wait a minute."
On impulse, she stopped and pulled off her leather buskins and stockings, pushing them carelessly into the rucksack on her shoulder. She stood still, eyes closed in ecstasy, wiggling long bare toes in a patch of damp moss.
"Oh, Roger, try it. This is wonderful."
He lifted one eyebrow, but obligingly set down the gun. He had taken it when they left the house, and she had let him, despite a proprietorial urge to carry it herself, undid his own footgear, and cautiously slid one long-boned foot into the moss beside hers. His eyes closed involuntarily, and his mouth rounded into a soundless ooh. Moved by impulse, she leaned over and kissed him. His eyes flew open in startlement, but he had fast reflexes. He wrapped a long arm around her waist and kissed her back thoroughly. It was an unusually warm day for late autumn, and he wore no coat, only a hunting shirt. His chest felt startlingly immediate through the woolen cloth of his shirt. She could feel the tiny bump of his nipple rising under the palm of her hand. God knew what might have happened next, but the wind changed. A faint cry drifted up from the sea of tossing yellow below. It might have been a baby's cry, or perhaps only a distant crow, but her head swiveled toward it like a compass needle pointing to true north. It broke the mood, and he let go, stepping back.
"Do you want to go back?"
he asked, sounding resigned. She pressed her lips together and shook her head.
No, let's get a little farther away from the house, though. We don't want to bother them with a noise. Of shooting, I mean.
He grinned, and she felt the blood rise hot in her face.
No, she couldn't pretend she hadn't realized there was more than one motive for this private expedition.
No, not that either, he said.
He stooped for his shoes and stockings.
Come on, then.
She declined to put on her own footwear, but took the opportunity to reappropriate the gun. It wasn't that she didn't trust him with it, though he admitted he hadn't fired such a gun before. She just liked the feel of it, and felt secure with its weight balanced on her shoulder, even unloaded. A land pattern musket, it was more than 5 feet long and weighed a good 10 pounds or so, but the butt of the polished walnut stock fitted snugly into her hand, and the weight of the steel barrel felt right, laid in the hollow of her shoulder, muzzle to the sky.
"You're going to go barefoot?"
Roger cast a quizzical glance at her feet, then ahead, up the mountainside, where a faint path wove through blackberry brambles and fallen branches.
"Just for a while," she assured him. "I used to go barefoot all the time when I was little. Daddy, Frank, took us to the mountains every summer, to the White Mountains or the Adirondacks. After a week, the bottoms of my feet were like leather. I could have walked on hot coals and not felt a thing."
I did too,
he said, smiling,
and tucked his shoes away as well. Granted, he said, with a nod toward the faint path that wove its way through brush and half-buried granite outcrops, the walking along the river bank of the Ness or the shingle by the Firth was a bit easier going than this, stones notwithstanding.
That's a point, she said, frowning slightly at his feet. Have you had a tetanus shot recently, in case you step on something sharp and get punctured?
He was already climbing ahead of her, choosing his footing cautiously.
I had injections for everything one could possibly have injections for before I came through the stones, he assured her, over one shoulder. Typhoid, cholera, dengue fever, the lot. I'm sure tetanus was in there.
Dengue fever?
I thought I'd had shots for everything too, but not that one.
Digging her toes into the cool mats of dead grass, she took a few long strides to catch him up.
Shouldn't need it up here.
The path ambled round the curve of a steep bank overgrown with yellowing pawpaw and vanished under the overhang of a clump of black-green hemlock. He held the heavy branches back for her, and she ducked under them into the pungent gloom, gun held carefully crosswise.
I wasn't sure where I might have to go, see?
His voice came from behind her, casual, damped by the darkened air under the trees.
If it was the coastal towns or the West Indies, there were...
There are, he corrected himself automatically, any number of entertaining African diseases brought in by the slave ships.
Thought I'd best be prepared.
She took advantage of the rough terrain not to answer, but was dismayed and at the same time rather shamefully pleased to discover the lengths to which he'd been prepared to go in order to follow and find her. The ground was covered with a mottled brown of shed needles, but so damp that there was neither crackle nor prick beneath her feet. It felt spongy, cool, and pleasant under her bare soles, with a give to it that made her think the mass of dead needles must be a foot thick at least.
Ow!
Roger, not so lucky in his passage, had set his foot on a rotten persimmon and slid, barely catching himself by grabbing hold of a holly bush, which promptly stabbed him with its prickly leaves.
Shit, he said, sucking the wounded thumb.
Good thing about the tetanus, eh?
She laughed in agreement, but found herself worrying as they climbed. What about Jemmy when he began to walk and clamber over mountains barefoot? She'd seen enough of the small MacLeods and Chisholms, to say nothing of Germaine, to realise that small boys punctured, scraped, lacerated and fractured themselves on a weekly basis at least. She and Roger were protected against things like diphtheria and typhoid. Jemmy would have no such protection. She swallowed, remembering the night before. That murderous horse of her father's had bitten him in the arm, and Claire had made Jamie sit down shirtless before the fire while she cleaned and dressed the bite. Jamie had poked a curious head up from his cradle, and his grandfather, smiling, had scooped him out and taken him upon his knee.
"Gallopy trot, gallopy trot,"
he'd chanted, bouncing a delighted Jemmy gently up and down.
"'Tis a wicked horse that I have got. Gallopy trot, gallopy trot. Let's send him to hell and then he'll be hot."
It wasn't the charming scene of the two redheads giggling at each other that stuck in her mind, though. It was the firelight glowing in her son's translucent, perfect, untouched skin, and shining silver on the webbed scars across her father's back, black-red on the bloody gash in his arm. It was a dangerous time for men. She couldn't keep Jem safe from harm, she knew that. But the thought of him, or Roger, being injured or ill made her stomach knot and cold sweat come out on the sides of her face. "Is your thumb all right?" She turned back toward Roger, who looked surprised, having forgotten all about his thumb.
"What?"
He looked at it, puzzled.
"Aye, of course."
Nonetheless, she took his hand and kissed the wounded thumb.
"You be careful,"
she said fiercely. He laughed and looked surprised when she glared at him.
"I will," he said, sobering a little.
He nodded at the gun she carried.
"Don't worry. I may not have fired one, but I know a wee bit about them. I won't blow my fingers off. Does this look all right for a bit of practice?"
They had come out into a heathwold, a high meadow thick with grass and rhododendron. There was a stand of aspen at the far side, their pale branches aflutter with a few late tatters of gold and crimson leaves, vivid against the deep blue sky. A stream gurgled downhill somewhere out of sight, and a red-tailed hawk circled high overhead. The sun was well up now, warm on her shoulders, and there was a pleasant grassy bank nearby.
"Just right," she said,
and swung the gun down from her shoulder. It was a beautiful gun, more than 5 feet long, but so perfectly balanced you could rest it across your outstretched arm without a wobble, which Brianna was doing by way of demonstration. "See," she said, pulling her arm in and sweeping the stock up to her shoulder in one fluid movement. "That's the balance point. You want to put your left hand right there, grab the stock by the trigger with your right, and butt it back into your shoulder. Snug it in, really solidly. There's some kick to it." She bumped the burled walnut stock gently into the socket of her buckskin shoulder in illustration, then lowered the gun and handed it to Roger with a somewhat more tender caution than she showed when handing him her infant child, he noted wryly. On the other hand, so far as he could tell, Jemmy was much more indestructible than the gun. She showed him, hesitant at first, reluctant to correct him. He bit his own tongue, though, and imitated her carefully, following the smooth flow of the steps from ripping the cartridge open with his teeth to priming, loading, ramming, and checking, annoyed at his own novice awkwardness, but secretly fascinated, and more than slightly aroused, by the casual ferocity of her movements. Her hands were nearly as large as his own, though finely boned. She handled the long gun with the familiarity other women showed with needle and broom. She wore breeks of homespun, and the long muscle of her thigh rose up tight and round against the cloth when she squatted beside him, head bent as she groped in her leather bag.
"What? You packed a lunch?" he joked. "I thought we'd just shoot something and eat it."
She ignored him. She pulled out a ragged white kerchief to use as a target, and shook it out, frowning critically. Once, he had thought of her scent as jasmine and grass. Now she smelled of gunpowder, leather, and sweat. He breathed it, his fingers unobtrusively stroking the wood of the gun stock.
"Ready?" she said, glancing at him with a smile.
"Oh, aye," he said.
"Check your flint and priming," she said, rising. "I'll pin up the target."
Seen from the back, her ruddy hair clubbed tightly back and clad in a loose buckskin hunting shirt that covered her from shoulder to thigh, her resemblance to her father was intensified to a startling degree.
No mistaking the two, though, he thought. Breeks or no, Jamie Fraser had never in his life had an arse like that.
He watched her walk, congratulating himself on his choice of instructor. His father-in-law would have given him a lesson willingly. Jamie was a fine shot and a patient teacher. Roger had seen him taking the Chisholm boys out after supper to practice blasting away at rocks and trees in the empty cornfield. It was one thing for Jamie to know that Roger was inexperienced with guns. It was another to suffer the humiliation of demonstrating just how inexperienced under that dispassionate blue gaze. Beyond the matter of pride, though, he had an ulterior motive in asking Brianna to come out shooting with him. Not that he thought said motive was in any way hidden. Claire had glanced from him to her daughter when he had suggested it, and looked amused in a particularly knowing way that had made Brianna frown and say, "Mother," in an accusatory tone of voice. Beyond the all too brief hours of their wedding night at the gathering, this was the first and only time he'd had Brianna to himself, free from the insatiable demands of her offspring. He caught the gleam of sun off metal as she lowered her arm. She was wearing his bracelet, he realized, with a deep feeling of pleasure. He had given it to her when he'd asked her to marry him, a lifetime ago, in the freezing mists of a winter night in Inverness. It was a simple circlet of silver, engraved with a series of phrases in French. "Je t'aime," it said. "I love you. Un peu, beaucoup, passionnement, pas du tout." A little, a lot, passionately, not at all. "Passionnement," he murmured, envisioning her wearing nothing but his bracelet and her wedding ring. "First things first, though," he told himself, and picked up a fresh cartridge. After all, they had time. Satisfied that his loading habits were on the way to being well established, if not yet rapid, Brianna finally allowed him to practice sighting, and at last, to shoot. It took a dozen tries before he could hit the white square of the kerchief, but the sense of exultation he felt when a dark spot appeared suddenly near the edge of it had him reaching for a fresh cartridge before the smoke of the shot had dissipated. The sense of excited accomplishment took him through another dozen cartridges, scarcely noticing anything beyond the jerk and boom of the gun, the flash of powder, and the breathless instant of realization when he saw an occasional shot go home. The kerchief hung in tatters by this time, and small clouds of whitish smoke floated over the meadow. The hawk had decamped at the sound of the first shot, along with all the other birds of the neighbourhood, though the ringing in his ears sounded like a whole chorus of distant titmice. He lowered the gun and looked at Brianna, grinning, whereupon she burst into laughter. "You look like the end man in a minstrel show," she said, the end of her nose going pink with amusement. "Here, clean up a little, and we'll try shooting from farther away." She took the gun and handed him a clean handkerchief in exchange. He wiped black soot from his face, watching as she swiftly swabbed the barrel and reloaded. She straightened, then heard something. Her head rose suddenly, eyes fixed on an oak across the meadow. Ears still ringing from the roar of the gun, Roger had heard nothing. Swinging round, though, he caught a flicker of movement, a dark grey squirrel poised on a pine branch at least 30 feet above the ground. Without the slightest hesitation, Brianna raised the gun to her shoulder and seemed to fire in the same motion. The branch directly under the squirrel exploded in a shower of wood chips, and the squirrel, blown off its feet, plunged to the ground, bouncing off the springy evergreen branches as it went. Roger ran across to the foot of the tree, but there was no need to hurry. The squirrel lay dead, limp as a furry rag. "Good shot," he said in congratulation, holding up the corpse as Brianna came to see. "But there's not a mark on him. You must have scared him to death." Brianna gave him a level look from beneath her brows.
"If I'd meant to hit him, Roger, I'd have hit him," she said, with a slight edge of reproof. "And if I had hit him, you'd be holding a handful of squirrel mush. You don't aim right at something that size. You aim to hit just under them and knock them down. It's called barking," she explained, like a kindly kindergarten teacher correcting a slow pupil.
"Why?"
He repressed a small sense of irritation.
"Your father teach you that?"
She gave him a slightly odd look before replying. "No, Ian did." He made a non-committal noise in response to that. Ian was a point of awkwardness in the family. Brianna's cousin had been well-loved, and he knew the whole family missed him. Still, they hesitated to speak of young Ian before Roger, out of delicacy. It hadn't exactly been Roger's fault that Ian Murray had remained with the Mohawk, but there was no denying that he had had a part in the matter. If he hadn't killed that Indian... Not for the first time he pushed aside the confused memories of that night in Snaketown, but felt, nonetheless, the physical echoes, the quicksilver rush of terror through his belly, and the judder of impact through the muscles of his forearms as he drove the broken end of the wooden pole with all his strength into a shadow that had sprung up before him out of the shrieking dark. A very solid shadow. Brianna had crossed the meadow and set up another target, three irregular chunks of wood set on a stump the size of a dinner table. Without comment, he wiped his sweating hands on his breeks and concentrated on the new challenge. But Ian Murray refused to leave his mind. He'd barely seen the man, but remembered him clearly. Hardly more than a youth, tall and gangly, with a homely but appealing face. He couldn't think of Murray's face without seeing it as he last had, scabbed with a line of freshly tattooed dots that looped across the cheeks and over the bridge of his nose. His face was brown from the sun, but the skin of his freshly plucked scalp had been a fresh and startling pink, naked as a baby's bum, and blotched red from the irritation of the plucking. "What's the matter?" Brianna's voice startled him, and the barrel jerked up as he fired, the shot going wild. Or wilder, rather. He hadn't managed to hit any of the wooden blocks in a dozen shots. He lowered the gun and turned to her. She was frowning, but didn't look angry, only puzzled and concerned. "What's wrong?" she asked again. He took a deep breath and rubbed his sleeve across his face, careless of the smears of black soot.
"Your cousin," he said abruptly. "I'm sorry about him, Bree."
Her face softened and the worried frown eased a little.
"Oh," she said.
She laid a hand on his arm and drew near, so he felt the warmth of her closeness. She sighed deeply and laid her forehead against his shoulder.
"Well," she said at last, "I'm sorry too, but it isn't any more your fault than mine or Dar's, or Ian's for that matter."
She gave a small snort that might have been intended for a laugh.
"If it's anyone's fault, it's Lizzie's, and nobody blames her."
He smiled at that, a little wryly.
"Aye, I see,"
he answered, and cupped a hand over the cool smoothness of her plait.
"You're right. And yet, I killed a man, Bree."
She didn't startle or jerk away, but somehow went completely still. So did he. It was the last thing he'd meant to say.
"You never told me that before,"
she said at last, raising her head to look at him. She sounded tentative, unsure whether to pursue the matter. The breeze lifted a strand of hair across her face, but she didn't move to brush it away.
Well, to tell you the truth, I've scarcely thought of it."
He dropped his hand, and the stasis was broken. She shook herself a little and stood back.
"That sounds terrible, doesn't it? But..."
He struggled for words. He'd not meant to say anything, but now he'd started, it seemed urgently necessary to explain.
to put it into proper words.
It was at night, during a fight in the village. I escaped. I had a bit of broken pole in my hand, and when someone loomed up out of the darkness, I...
His shoulders slumped suddenly as he realised that there was no possible way to explain. Not really. He looked down at the gun he still held.
I didn't know it killed him, he said quietly, eyes on the flint. I didn't even see his face. I still don't know who it was, though it had to be someone I knew.
Snake Town was a small village.
I knew all Neronanque.
Why? He wondered suddenly. Had he never once thought of asking who the dead man was?
Plain enough. He hadn't asked because he didn't want to know.
Neronanque? She repeated the words uncertainly.
The men, the warriors, braves, it's what they call themselves. The Kayenkahaka.
The Mohawk words felt strange on his tongue, alien and familiar at once. He could see wariness on her face, and knew his speaking of it had sounded odd to her. Not the way one uses a foreign term, handling it gingerly, but the way her father sometimes casually mingled Gaelic and Scots, mind seizing on the most available word in either language. He stared down at the gun in his hand, as though he'd never seen one before. He wasn't looking at her, but felt her draw near again, still tentative but not repulsed.
"Are you sorry about it?"
"No," he said at once, and looked up at her. "I mean, I am sorry it happened, but sorry I did it? No."
He had spoken without pausing to weigh his words and was surprised and relieved to find them true.
He'd felt regret, as he'd told her, but what guilt there was had nothing to do with the Shadow's death, whoever it had been. He had been a slave in Snake Town and had no great love for any of the Mohawk, though some were decent enough. He'd not intended killing, but had defended himself. He'd do it again, in the same circumstance.
Yet there was a small canker of guilt, the realisation of just how easily he had dismissed that death. The Kayenkahaka sang and told stories of their dead, and kept their memory alive around the fires of the longhouses, naming them for generations and recounting their deeds. Just as the Highlanders did. He thought suddenly of Jamie Fraser, face ablaze at the great fire of the gathering, calling his people by name and by lineage.
"Stand by my hand, Roger the Singer, son of Jeremiah Mackenzie."
Perhaps Ian Murray found the Mohawk not so strange after all. Still, he felt obscurely as though he had deprived the unknown dead man of name as well as life, seeking to blot him out by forgetting, to behave as though that death had never happened, only to save himself from the knowledge of it. And that, he thought, was wrong. Her face was still, but not frozen. Her eyes rested on his with something like compassion. Still, he looked away, back at the gun whose barrel he gripped. His fingers, soot-stained, had left greasy black ovals on the metal. She reached out and took it from him, rubbing the marks away with the hem of her shirt. He let her take it and watched, rubbing his dirty fingers against the side of his breeches.
"It's just... does it not seem that if you must kill a man, it should be on purpose, meaning it?"
She didn't answer, but her lips pursed slightly, then relaxed.
"If you shoot someone with this, Roger, it will be on purpose," she said quietly.
She looked up at him then, blue eyes intent, and he saw that what he had taken for compassion was, in fact, a fierce stillness, like the small blue flames in a burned-out log.
"And if you have to shoot someone, Roger, I want you to mean it."
2 dozen rounds later, he could hit the wooden blocks at least once in 6 tries.
He would have kept it up doggedly, but she could see the muscles in his forearms beginning to tremble as he lifted the gun, stilled by effort of will. He would begin to miss more often now, out of fatigue, and that would do him no good. Or her. Her breasts were beginning to ache, engorged with milk. She'd have to do something about it soon. "Let's go and eat," she said, smiling as she took the musket from him after the last shot. "I'm starving." The exertion of shooting, reloading, putting up targets had kept them both warm, but it was nearly winter and the air was cold, much too cold, she thought regretfully, to lie naked in the dry ferns. But the sun was warm, and with forethought she had packed two ratty quilts in her rucksack along with the lunch. He was quiet, but it was a comfortable quiet. She watched him cut slivers from the chunk of hard cheese, dark lashes lowered, and admired the long-limbed, competent look of him, fingers neat and quick, gentle mouth compressed slightly as he concentrated on his work, a drop of sweat rolling down the high brown curve of his cheekbone, in front of his ear. She wasn't sure what to make of what he had told her. Still, she knew enough to realise that it was a good thing that he had told her, even though she didn't like to hear or think of his time with the Mohawk. It had been a bad time for her, alone, pregnant, doubting whether he or her parents would ever return, as well as for him. She reached to accept a bit of cheese, brushed his fingers with her own, and leaned forward to make him kiss her. He did, then sat back, his eyes gone soft green and clear, free of the shadow that had haunted them. "Pizza," he said. She blinked, then laughed. It was one of their games, taking turns to think of things they missed from the other time, the time before or after, depending how you looked at it. "Coke," she said promptly. "I think I could maybe do pizza, but what good is pizza without Coca-Cola?" "Pizza with beer is perfectly fine," he assured her, "and we can have beer. Not that Lizzie's homemade hell brew is quite on a par with McEwen's lager yet. But you really think you could make pizza? Don't see why not." She nibbled at the cheese, frowning. "This wouldn't do." She brandished the yellowish remnant, then popped it in her mouth. "Too strong flavoured. But I think..." She paused to chew and swallow, then washed it down with a long drink of rough cider. "Come to think of it, this would go pretty well with pizza." She lowered the leather bottle and licked the last sweet semi-alcoholic drops from her lips. "But the cheese? I think maybe sheep's cheese would do. Da brought some from Salem last time he went there. I'll ask him to get some more and see how it melts." She squinted against the bright, pale sun, calculating. "Mama's got plenty of dried tomatoes and tons of garlic. I know she has basil. Don't know about the oregano, but I could do without that. And crust." She waved a dismissive hand. "Flour, water and lard, nothing to it." He laughed, handing her a biscuit filled with ham and Mrs. Bug's piccalilli. "How pizza came to the colonies," he said, and lifted the cider bottle in brief salute. "Folk always wonder where humanity's great inventions come from. Now we know." He spoke lightly, but there was an odd tone in his voice, and his glance held hers. "Maybe we do know," she said softly, after a moment. "You ever think about it? Why? Why we're here?"
"Of course."
The green of his eyes was darker now, but still clear.
"So do you, eh?"
She nodded and took a bite of biscuit and ham, the piccalilli sweet with onion and pungent in her mouth. Of course they thought of it, she and Roger and her mother. For surely it had meaning, that passage through the stones. It must. And yet, her parents seldom spoke of war and battle, but from the little they said, and the much greater quantity she had read, she knew just how random and how pointless such things could sometimes be. Sometimes a shadow rises, and death lies nameless in the dark. Roger crumbled the last of his bread between his fingers and tossed the crumbs a few feet away. A chickadee flew down, pecked once,
and was joined within seconds by a flock that swooped down out of the trees,
vacuuming up the crumbs with chattering efficiency. He stretched, sighing, and lay back on the quilt.
"Well," he said, "if you ever figure it out, you'll be sure to tell me, won't you?"
Her heartbeat was tingling in her breasts, no longer safely contained behind the rampart of her breastbone, but set loose to crackle through her flesh, small jolts of electricity tweaking her nipples. She didn't dare to think of Jem. The barest hint of him, and her milk would let down in a gush. Before she could let herself think too much about it, she pulled the hunting shirt over her head. Roger's eyes were open, fixed on her, soft and brilliant as the moss beneath the trees. She undid the knot of the linen strip and felt the cool touch of the wind on her bare breasts. She cupped them in her hands, feeling the heaviness rise, begin to tingle and crest. "Come here," she said softly, eyes on his. "Hurry, I need you." They lay half-clothed and comfortably tangled beneath the tattered quilt, sleepy and sticky with half-dried milk, the heat of their joining still warm around them. The sun through the empty branches overhead made black ripples behind the lids of her closed eyes, as though she looked down through a dark red sea, wading in the blood-warm water, seeing black volcanic sand change and ripple round her feet. Was he awake? She didn't turn her head or open her eyes to see, but tried to send a message to him. A slow, lazy pulse of a heartbeat, a question surging from blood to blood. "Are you there?" she asked silently. She felt the question move up through her chest and out along her arm. She imagined the pale underside of her arm and the blue vein along it, as though she might see some telltale subterranean flash as the impulse threaded through her blood and down her forearm, reached her palm, her finger, and delivered the faintest throb of its pressure against his skin. Nothing happened at once. She could hear his breathing, slow and regular, a counterpoint to the sough of breeze through trees and grass, like surf coming in upon a sandy shore. She imagined herself as a jellyfish, he another. She could see them clearly, two transparent bodies lucent as the moon, veils pulsing in and out in hypnotic rhythm, borne on the tide toward one another, tendrils trailing, slowly touching. His finger crossed her palm so lightly it might have been the brush of fin or feather.
"I'm here," it said. "And you?"
Her hand closed over it, and he rolled toward her. Late in the year as it was, the light died early. It was still a month till the winter solstice, but by mid-afternoon the sun was already brushing the slope of Black Mountain, and their shadows stretched to impossible lengths before them as they turned eastward toward home. She carried the gun. Instruction was over for the day, and while they weren't hunting, if the opportunity of game offered, she would take it. The squirrel she had killed earlier was already cleaned and tucked in her sack, but that was barely flavouring for a vegetable stew. A few more would be nice. Or a possum, she thought dreamily. She wasn't sure of the habits of possum, though. Perhaps they hibernated over winter, and if so, they might already be gone. The bears were still active. She'd seen half-dried scat on the trail and scratches on the bark of a pine, still oozing yellow sap. A bear was good game, but she didn't mean either to look for one or to risk shooting at one unless it attacked them, and that wasn't likely. Leave bears alone and they'll generally leave you alone. Both her fathers had told her that, and she thought it excellent advice. A covey of bobwhite blasted out of a nearby bush like exploding shrapnel, and she jerked, heart in her mouth.
"Those are good to eat, aren't they?"
Roger nodded at the last of the disappearing grey-white blobs. He'd been startled too, but less than she had, she noticed with annoyance. "Yeah," she said, disgruntled at being taken unawares.
"But you don't shoot them with a musket." unless all you want is feathers for a pillow.
You use a fowling piece with birdshot. It's like a shotgun.
I know, he said shortly.
She felt disinclined to talk, jarred out of their peaceful mood. Her breasts were beginning to swell again. It was time to go home, to find Jemmy. Her step quickened a little at the thought, even as her mind reluctantly surrendered the memory of the pungent smell of crushed dry fern, the glow of sunlight on Roger's bare brown shoulders above her, the hiss of her milk gilding his chest in a spray of fine droplets, slick and warm and cool by turns between their writhing bodies. She sighed deeply and heard him laugh low in his throat.
Hmm?
She turned her head, and he motioned to the ground before them. They'd begun to move together as they walked, neither noticing the unconscious pull of the gravitational force that bound them. Now their shadows had merged at the top, so an odd four-legged beast paced spider-like before them, its two heads tilted toward each other. He put an arm around her waist, and one shadow head dipped, joining the other in a single bulbous shape.
"It's been a good day, aye," he said softly.
"Aye, it has," she said, and smiled. She might have spoken further, but a sound came to her above the rattle of tree branches, and she pulled suddenly away.
"What?"
he began. But she put a finger to her lips to shush him, beckoning as she crept toward a growth of red oak. It was a flock of turkeys, scratching companionably in the earth beneath a large oak tree, turning up winter grubs from the mat of fallen leaves and acorns. The late sun shone low, lighting the iridescence in their breast feathers, so the birds' drab black glimmered with tiny rainbows as they moved. She had the gun already loaded, but not primed. She groped for the powder flask at her belt and filled the pan, scarcely looking away from the birds. Roger crouched beside her, intent as a hound dog on the scent. She nudged him and held the gun toward him in invitation, one eyebrow up. The turkeys were no more than 20 yards away, and even the smaller ones were the size of footballs. He hesitated, but she could see the desire to try it in his eyes. She thrust the gun firmly into his hands and nodded toward a gap in the brush. He shifted carefully, trying for a clear line of sight. She hadn't taught him to fire from a crouch as yet, and he wisely didn't try. Instead, standing, though it meant firing downward. He hesitated, the long barrel wavering as he shifted his aim from one bird to another, trying to choose the best shot. Her fingers curled and clenched, aching to correct his aim, to pull the trigger. She felt him draw breath and hold it. Then three things happened so quickly as to seem simultaneous. The gun went off with a huge vroom. A spray of dried oak leaves fountained up from the earth under the tree, and 15 turkeys lost their minds, running like a demented football squad straight at them, gobbling hysterically. The turkeys reached the brush, saw Roger, and took to the air like flying soccer balls, wings frantically clapping the air. Roger ducked to avoid one that soared an inch above his head, only to be struck in the chest by another. He reeled backward, and the turkey, clinging to his shirt, seized the opportunity to run nimbly up his shoulder and push off, raking the side of his neck with its claws. The gun flew through the air. Brianna caught it, flipped a cartridge from the box on her belt, and was grimly reloading and ramming as the last turkey ran toward Roger, zigged away, saw her, zagged in the other direction, and finally zoomed between them, gobbling alarms and imprecations. She swung around, sighted on it as it left the ground, caught the black blob outlined for a split second against the brilliant sky, and blasted it in the tail feathers. It dropped like a sack of coal, and hit the ground 40 yards away with an audible thud. She stood still for a moment, then slowly lowered the gun. Roger was staring at her, open-mouthed, pressing the cloth of his shirt against the bloody scratches on his neck. She smiled at him, a little weakly, feeling her hands sweaty on the wooden stock, and her heart pounding with delayed reaction.
"Holy God," Roger said, deeply impressed.